Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Stompcast with me, Dr. Alex George. This is the podcast where I go for a walk with a guest to take a little wander into their life. This week I'm stomping with Dr. Ian Jordan. Ian is the clinical lead for Mettle, the men's mental fitness app we proudly launched at the end of 2023. Ian is a psychiatrist and therapist who has 20 years of experience in psychiatry and psychotherapy. Ian was one of the key medical professionals behind the app, and the way he articulates complex medical terminology in a digestible way is incredible, so I knew I had to get him on the Stompcast. Now, the focus of this conversation isn't going to be about Mettle. In fact, I'm just giving you that knowledge as context for you to understand our relationship, and I think it's important for transparency that you know how I know someone. This conversation is going to explore, I think, some powerful things that we should think about as a society, one of which is around psychedelics. Is there a role of psychedelics in the treatment of mental illness? Should we be using them? Where are we at? What does the research show? What is the science behind mental health and interventions in mental health? What actually works from the perspective of a researcher, which Dr. Ian is, but also from the perspective of someone who's been a psychiatrist for a long time, what stuff actually works? In the third part, we're going to think about recovery and mental fitness. What does mental fitness actually mean? What should we aim for and how do we get there? This is going to be an incredibly powerful and enlightening conversation. I'm excited that you're going to hear it. Let's delve in. Ian, welcome to the Stompcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks very much for having me.
And how has your morning been? You've been in a clinic this morning.
I was in clinic, yeah. It's very nice to be out of the house, actually. I feel a bit like a kind of a rat in a cage this week, so it's lovely to be out.
So were you doing your clinic from home today?
Clinic from home today, yeah.
What kind of clinic was it today? What kind of cases, what things are you talking about, what you're seeing?
So most of the last 15 years I've worked in general hospitals, so seeing surgical and medical patients with highly complex physical presentations, so people with complex and chronic physical symptoms. And that's most of what I do on a Friday. I work in an integrative clinic, so I work with very experienced functional medicine physicians and lifestyle coaches, physiotherapists, a whole group of different people who can approach physical and mental illness from different perspectives. So we do kind of a whole package.
Are you seeing patients then that have like physical presentations, but thinking what role does the mind or the brain have in what you're seeing? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, what role does the mind have? So often people will have chronic symptoms, and they're often syndromes about which we don't know very much. So the approach is sometimes sort of a trial and error approach. Often we bring in kind of lifestyle, fitness, nutrition, and inevitably, either as a cause or a consequence, there are psychological components. Such as, for instance, people who have chronic symptoms tend to pay attention to their symptoms all the time, get preoccupied by them, very distressed by them, and then stress has an effect on the body, and so it's a vicious cycle. So those are the types of things where I come in and try and help people address those.
It's been really interesting, I think, for me, going through med school, then working primarily in A&E, a couple of other kind of rotations as a junior, but primarily being in A&E, and realising that actually a lot of the things we learned at med school, not that it wasn't right, but perhaps it wasn't the whole picture. Yeah. The kind of realization that we separate so much of physical health from mental health, and you kind of put it in different boxes. I actually had a very interesting conversation this morning with an MP. Obviously, I wouldn't name this MP, but they'd had a serious physical illness last year, and they said the really interesting thing is that the most distressing thing was the mental health. What happened to their mental health after having that, then being paranoid about having the sudden event again or something happening to them, or worry about their health, worry about whether they could go and do the things they enjoyed, in some aspect initially not being able to do things they enjoyed. And what our conversation was like, God, maybe we need to actually think not just about once people present, say, with a heart attack or a stroke or whatever, in terms of the physical thing. So what knock-on effect does that have on the rest of the person's life?
Huge. Yeah, so two things that I think are really critical there that I think most healthcare doesn't address. The first is that people's experience of healthcare is hugely determined by the experience of the people that they meet, right? So, I mean, you'll remember from medical school, famously, people don't complain typically and sue doctors because they've had bad care. They complain because, you know, they weren't communicated with well, they weren't taken care of during their hospital stay, people didn't treat them respectfully and with dignity. And so all of that packaging around the actual technicalities of what was physically wrong with you, say, are crucially important. And it's sort of fundamentally therapy, really, psychotherapy, really, you know, all the stuff around it. And the second thing is that the traditional disease model of, you know, you have a symptom which is caused by a disease and then you treat the disease and then the symptoms go away, which has been has revolutionized the health of the world, it doesn't actually work for most presentations, physical or mental. You know, about 70% of things people go to their GP with, no definitive cause is found. And the things that are causing it are likely to be things like emotional health, lifestyle, nutrition, you know, the context that they're in and so on. So I think those are critical, and we have a healthcare system that's focused on diseases, not really on health.
And that's something really that I found fascinating. I'm doing a public mental health master at King's. I'm nearly at the end of it now. And something that I've really found so interesting is exactly that point, that actually, this is a broad sweep, but when you look at things, most of what we do in this country, have done for many years, is around like identify disease, treat disease, and hope the symptoms get better.
Yeah.
Not so much on the preventative side of things, but very like a disease focused thing, like let's find the problem through tests, let's try and treat it and see if they get better. And interestingly, I think probably one of the frustrations of when I was working in A&E was that a lot of the time it was about finding out the most imminent serious problem that's going to kill the person, hopefully treat it, and if it's not one of those like immediate most likely dangerous things, we'll rule stuff out. And then if we think it's like, okay, it's nothing serious, we send the patient home. Yeah. And I think for a patient, that's a very frustrating thing, because often you come to A&E thinking, right, I'm going to get diagnosed. Yeah. I'm going to go home knowing what's going on. I'm going to be treated. I'm going to get better. And obviously, that's the dream situation. A lot of the time, that does happen. But a significant proportion of the time, we go, okay, your chest pain is not caused by, you know, an MI. It's not a heart attack. It's not caused by a clot in your lungs, etc. You know, go home and see your GP.
Yeah.
That's a really unsatisfactory thing for a patient, isn't it?
It's an inevitable consequence.
And for us as doctors, actually, as well.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I you know, doctors are unhappier than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. You know, my uncle, who's a GP, who's retiring, I know that his practice was always to sit down, take time with people, understand, really get to know people, rather than a model now, which is 7-minute consultation. Mm. You know, it's not individual doctor's fault. It's a healthcare system. It's an inevitable consequence of a healthcare system that's constantly struggling to keep up with demand.
Yeah, and I think that's, if you talk to a lot of doctors and things about like their frustrations at the moment, of course you've got all the kind of strikes and everything happening. It's kind of like pay becomes like the big focus of what the conversation's about, but it's so much wider than that as an issue, isn't it? It's so much about like the satisfaction, and ultimately, like, you don't become a doctor because you think you're going to be rich. Well,
no.
If you did, you really made a horrible mistake.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, like, of course doctors do earn some money, and it's all relative in comparison, obviously, but if being rich is your primary goal, there's much easier ways, quicker ways, and better ways, arguably, to become wealthy. It's all about you doing it, because really you want to do something like meaningful and help people. It is that altruism, I guess, that drives a lot of people into medicine. But it seems that for a lot of medics, sometimes before they even graduated, but particularly in the first few years, that's driven out of them almost. There's almost you almost feel this sense of resentment towards the system and the job. And it's so sad, because a lot of it comes down to burnout, but you almost lose that, not empathy, but you're like, what's the point? I can't do my job properly, so what's the point? That kind of feeling.
Yeah, and I think, you know, strikes might be superficially about money, but they're much more about, working conditions and, you know, respect and being able to provide good quality care, because doctors do genuinely want to provide good quality care, and it's increasingly difficult, I think, because of the structures they work in. I left the NHS a year ago after 20 years of working in public health services in the UK and Ireland, because I didn't really feel like I was helping people anymore.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So yeah, this is a good point then to actually like look at a bit of your background and what you've done, because I really wanted to delve into a few things in this conversation.
Yeah.
One of which I'm really excited to talk to you about is psychedelics and the role of psychedelics in, yes, research, but also mental health. Like, what can we use them for? Is there a use and so on? But perhaps before we do that, I wonder if you could kind of recap how you've come to where you are today. You know, you've left the NHS about a year ago. You're heavily involved in research in this area. Of course, we met through METL, because you're
yes.
clinical lead for. We're very glad to have you, of course. Yeah, I just wondered if you could give a bit of a recap to your kind of journey, and then, yeah, we'll delve into what you're doing right now.
Yeah, I just a slightly circuitous journey. I always wanted to be a psychiatrist, so I was a pretty weird 18-year-old, you know.
Does that make you weird?
Yeah, I think so. But I worked in neuropathology for a while, and I was a palliative care doctor for a while. I did a few different things that interested me, and then went back to psychiatry and loved it. Liaison psychiatry was my passion. I liked the complexity of it. I liked the fact that you could spend lots of time with patients, right? Because they're on the ward, a sort of captive audience.
Just for people listening, what do you mean by liaison psychiatry?
Liaison psychiatry is a specialty of psychiatry that works in medical and surgical settings. So we see people who are in the hospital for any reason. So in Oxford, I worked predominantly in the major trauma center. So I saw people with PTSD who had been either they were veterans from the military, or they had been in car accidents, and I would prevent and treat PTSD. Or you might see people who are in hospital who are very sick with eating disorders, or you might see people who are very sick and have delirium, you know, they're confused. Mm. So it's a nice mix of kind of medical and psychiatric, which I...
You like the conundrums, really, clearly, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I like to pretend I'm, you know, house MD, you know, and kind of figure things out.
Hugh Laurie working. You're the real life. Yeah, yeah. You actually do look a bit like Hugh Laurie in a good philosophical way, in a good way.
Well, getting to that age, all right.
No. Not at all. So you kind of found your way through there. What happened then? So you're doing liaison psychiatry. So you became a consultant psychiatrist.
Yeah.
When did you start becoming more involved in research and like looking outwardly at like, okay, what's out there? What can we do?
I initially got involved in... So I trained as a psychotherapist in around 2007. And it was a very new way of thinking about suffering and why people experience what they experience and what are the different kind of underlying mechanisms. Because psychiatry kind of implicitly has a point of view, right? Which is that there are disorders and the disorders cause symptoms. But other approaches have a different point of view. And then I started studying complexity science, which is a branch of science that is like systems thinking, looks at the relationship between different things. And those two things together made me think quite differently, I think, about medicine and psychiatry. And so I started being curious about, you know, was this an approach I could take in the NHS, or would I need to kind of start doing it elsewhere? And so I started working with some charities and healthcare technologies who were thinking a bit differently. I developed lots of curricula and kind of psychotherapeutic content that was public-facing. Because I do have a deep sense that there are things about how your own mind works and about how other people's minds work that can help you navigate life, and that people can thrive and recover if they individually understand that, and if we all kind of understand that a little bit better. And then slowly, sort of edging into more diverse...
We've got an umbrella arrived.
Oh, great, we've got an umbrella.
Okay. We'll wait here for a minute.
Sorry.
Would you like a raincoat?
I'm okay.
Yeah, go on, you'll be cold otherwise. Pop one.
I'm nice.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Thanks.
I'm okay, actually. No, go on, because I think I'll give it here. I'll put it on. Will you hold that, sir?
Yeah, sure.
I'll take that. Wait, this is the beauty of the Stompcast, guys. I think we should keep this in, actually, so everyone knows we're like literally, we've got to deal with all conditions. We literally arrived, it was sunny. In fact, Abby was tempted to put the sun cream on. And within like 20 minutes, it was raining, now it's hailing. What's next?
Sure.
What's next is the question. Thank you. Right, I'll navigate us out of the bushes.
Get through here.
We're climbing through the bushes. Yes, sorry. I don't know where you were, actually. Where
yeah. So I started, experimenting with different ways I could help people through my work in the NHS and also through charities and also through working with healthcare companies. And then about a year ago, I was at a point where I had kind of left the NHS and I had finished up a couple of things. I thought, you know what? My wife is my wife's on her second career and she had started working again. I thought, maybe I'll take a bit of time off and relax, you know? And then about a day later, I got a phone call. Yeah, I know. I got a phone call from Tom, as the CEO of Clerkenwell Health, which is a specialist psychedelic research site and organization. And what they were doing really interested me. So I had been a psychedelic peer counselor, volunteer for years. I worked at Burning Man, supporting people who are having challenging psychedelic experiences. Mm. And
that must have been quite an interesting experience.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Burning Man Festival. So
yes.
So these are, let's be frank, so people have gone out there to try different psychedelics during the festival.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of like overseeing.
Yeah. So we have this big, beautiful tent. Very calm, very relaxing, and people who have, taken too much, or are having a challenging experience, which is common with psychedelics, would come to us, and then we sit down, we support them through it, and we help them kind of navigate what can be very uncomfortable and frightening, and then kind of support them to integrate that a little bit afterwards, and get back to the real world after they've been.
So what? And we were saying, and maybe this is a good point. So that when we talk about psychedelics for people that haven't heard, what do we mean? What does psychedelics mean?
Yeah. So psychedelics, broadly speaking, are a class of medications that cause a very unusual experience. Mm. So that might be an intensely emotional experience, and that can be beautiful, joyful experience, or can be deeply frightening, and they're often associated with visual distortions or hallucinations, so seeing things that aren't there. Classic psychedelics are things like LSD, psilocybin, which is in magic mushrooms, DMT, and so on, mescaline. And then lumped in with those sometimes are other medications that we're now using in research at Clerkenwell Health and other places to treat mental disorders. So things like MDMA, which people will know as ecstasy. It's the active ingredient that in ecstasy, but you may not be getting that if you buy it on the street, but that's what it's supposed to be. And ketamine as well, which is commonly used.
Because I'd know ketamine from use in A&E.
That's right.
I use ketamine a lot. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's actually a fantastic drug for pain and also as a sedative as well, isn't it? We say it's more cardio stable. It's better perhaps for patients with unstable hearts than other drugs, because a lot of people have heard of ketamine as a party drug, but actually it's fantastic as it has a beneficial effect, particularly for pre-hospital care, because it can cause that dissociation, people in a great degree of pain.
Yeah.
By giving ketamine, you're not only relieving that pain, you're also removing them perhaps a little bit from that feeling that they're having. It's an incredible drug. And then the interesting thing about psychedelics is that perhaps when you mention that, people go, wait, that is all about partying. You mentioned Burning Man. It's an interesting one, because I think historically, these medications or drugs, whatever, have been seen as primarily party drugs. So maybe people listening might be surprised to hear a psychiatrist involved in research from an Oxford researcher talking about these kind of things as like, well, hang on, there might be a benefit here for mental health. So why is the history? Why do we see it so much as a party drug? And are we missing a trick here, not thinking of this, of like, hang on, what's the potential?
Yeah.
I mean, you guys are obviously doing the research, but
that's right.
Perhaps we should, as a country, open our mind a little bit more to the possibilities.
I think so, and it's funny, because I'm in the world of psychedelics, I forget that actually people don't know that this is going on, a lot of doctors don't. Mm. And there was a great deal of interest in the 50s and 60s, and then there was the war on drugs, and there was a loss of interest in psychedelics. And I have a special license to prescribe Schedule 1 drugs, and so they're still Schedule 1 drugs, so they're still considered potentially dangerous, illegal, and no therapeutic benefit.
And by Schedule 1, you mean things like,
cocaine, ecstasy. Yeah, they're in the same schedule as those. But there is emerging very, very good evidence that some of them have the potential for causing enormous recovery and assisting a therapeutic journey for people. So, and there's a number of different ways of thinking about that. MDMA, for instance, causes a deeply pleasurable feeling. It causes people to feel very, very social and connected to others. And when we use MDMA and related medications to treat PTSD, a lot of the things that make therapy really hard certainly are out of the picture. You know, the shame and the guilt and the panic, you know, the deeply kind of physiological panicky symptoms that people get, those are kind of out of the picture. And so you can do the type of exposure work that is virtually curative, although we tend not to use that word in psychiatry, right? But virtually curative, you can do that work in a really effective way. And the results that we've seen in our studies of methylone, which is very like MDMA, have been really remarkable.
You know, it's interesting to have this conversation because yesterday we recorded a podcast episode with Josh, or Anxiety Josh as he's known online, and he's a psychotherapist who specializes in anxiety. And the biggest thing he was saying was like, actually, what we're trying to do is get people out to experience what it is that causes anxiety. So he gave examples of taking people out that had a fear of driving out in the car to drive.
Yeah.
Like, no, we're gonna go through this so that we can rewire the brain to learn that actually what you think is a threat response isn't a threat to you.
That's exactly right.
At all. So what you're saying is that these medications can help facilitate that experience?
That's right. So PTSD is an interesting one because there's lots of different ways of thinking about it. Now, you can think about mental disorders in lots of different ways. So if you speak to a geneticist, they'll talk about the genetics. If you speak to a psychologist, they'll talk about the psychology. If you speak to a neuroscientist, they'll talk about your brain networks. And I think probably the richest explanatory level for thinking about PTSD is that it's like a phobia to a memory. And a phobia is something that causes this like intensely frightening and unpleasant physiological response, you know, panic response, like adrenaline in your body. And normally the treatment for a phobia is just like you're saying, right? Exposure so that you learn that the thing you're afraid of isn't dangerous. But it's very difficult to expose to something that kind of lives inside your head and kind of jump out like a jack-in-the-box and cause you terrifying experiences. So what MDMA and related compounds do is that they turn off that physiological response virtually. And they also take away the shame and the guilt that people often feel, like survivor guilt and so on. And they allow people to expose to, think about, talk about, and process the awful thing that happened to them. And, I've seen it in front of my own eyes, you know, over the past year, that people get better really quickly with a therapist who's able to guide them through that.
You know, when you're talking about that, I was thinking about, people laugh when I say this story. I actually remember teaching med students about this and they were laughing about it. And I said, when I started and I applied to med school, the sight of a needle would virtually make me pass out. I'd literally have near syncope or pre-syncope. I was about to pass out when I saw a needle, and blood was something I just couldn't tolerate at all. But I went online, I thought, God, I really want to be a doctor. I need to get over this. And I kind of, this is years ago now, and I'd looked up and this guy was saying, now what you need to do with needle therapy is first of all to actually just get used to looking at needles, just on video first of all. So I started just sitting watching YouTube videos of needles, then I started videos of blood taking on video, then I eventually got like the tourniquets that you'd use to take, so tourniquets, you, if anyone listening, you tie it around the arm, which would dilate blood vessels, you can take blood from there. So then I'd start just using a tourniquet on my arm, just tying that on and just imagining that I had my blood taken.
Yeah.
Then eventually when I started going on clinics, first of all, I'd feel really faint whenever I'd see blood, but I was like, no, come on, I keep going to see cannulas being put in. Then I built upon that and I went to theatre, and I remember pretty much passing out and having to walk out a theatre, but I thought, no, come on. And I kept going back, and eventually it got to the point where I would say, when I was working in A&E, I could pretty much eat a roast dinner next to someone having a chest drain put in, or a open cardiac surgery. I mean, now I could say I could watch anything, and I don't think many things, only eyes, actually, little eyes.
Yeah, eyes
but
are
other
tough.
Than eyes, yeah. There's pretty much nothing that I wouldn't see operated on. It wouldn't bother me at all. And I think that's a good example.
That
of
is
that.
Such a rich example.
But I guess the thing that people go, that's fine when it's something like that, something out of your body. It's me exposing to that. Whereas I guess when you've got something like where you've got extreme PTSD, you've got something that's horrific, like entangled with a memory, for example, of something that's happened, that can be a really difficult thing to face, right?
So your example is lovely. And actually, I think I might use that in future as my graded exposure example, because that's what that's called. I usually use the spiders one, but I think that's better. And graded exposure works really well, because if you think about it, when you're exposed to something frightening but not dangerous, you can learn one of two things. You could, if you're overwhelmed, you learn, I can't do this, it's too much. But if it's manageable, you learn, actually, I can do this, right? So that's why we do graded exposure. Mm. It's very difficult to do graded exposure in PTSD, because you can't ease up to it. Because it would be like trying to do exposure of a phobia of dogs by putting you in a room with a hungry Rottweiler. Mm. What you tend to learn is, this is overwhelming, I can't do it. Mm. So people avoid more, their world shrinks, they get more anxious, their PTSD gets worse. It's hard to do. Very skilled clinicians can do it, and it works in a significant proportion of people. But these medications, supporting therapy, mean that we can do it faster with more people, more effectively.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And so when using this example, so maybe using an example for simplicity's sake, so if I was someone that really couldn't be even in a room with a needle, and I was like, I can't get past that barrier, like using MDMA-like substances, would that just turn the dial down on the fear response?
Yeah, it would. The experience is an experience of kind of deep pleasure, deep compassion for yourself and others, connection to others, and the fear response is very much reduced. So yeah, for other phobias it would work. It probably won't be used for that for some time, because it's early days and it's experimental. But I've always thought social anxiety would be a perfect use for it. I teach improv acting for social anxiety, and I'm an improv actor. And when I, before Clark and Well, nabbed me, and I now work there full time. That's what I was doing with my time. And
you are a man. You're a multi-hyphenate man.
I get bored easily. Yeah, and it would be the perfect thing for that. Can you imagine a group of people together, all with their intense social anxiety response turned down or turned off, with a feeling of connection to the other people, and relearning what it feels like to be comfortable around other people, to like yourself. My dream is to do a study like that someday.
Wow. It is genuinely incredible, isn't it, to think about that. I mean, do you know what we should do? I should go to some commissioners and see if we can get a documentary made.
And do that. Yeah, we could.
We should try and get a documentary done. You've got the license to prescribe.
Yeah.
I once said to some commissioners, I said, I'm so passionate about this that we need to be, opening our eyes to these things. I think the NHS, unfortunately, it is for many reasons that I do understand, it's a slow-moving beast, and I get that for many safety reasons. But perhaps if I'm happy to test different things, I'd be happy to try. I mean, to be a part of a process that was bringing awareness to something like this, where there's such huge benefits.
Huge. We'd have to do it it's only allowable within a trial at the moment. We hope that, so the FDA in America will hopefully announce towards the end of this year that it will license MDMA for use in PTSD with therapy. And at that stage, the UK will hopefully follow. So it has to be within a trial at the moment. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. We should definitely think about it.
I wonder if it's kind of treatments also particularly beneficial for those that do have extreme avoidance, not just avoidance in terms of trying to expose to something that's causing, say, the post-traumatic stress response or the anxiety type response, but those that are so closed off they won't even like talk about things. Because my dad, after losing my brother, which about, and he's so tightly held in with it that he won't even... It's not even an option to even discuss it. That something needs to almost relax and just unwind that to help him even engage. Because, I will go and do therapy. My mum does therapy and things, but my dad won't even do the therapy. He won't even walk in the therapist door.
Yeah.
So I wonder especially for blokes. And things.
So we've talked about the sort of MDMA methylone approach. And then classical psychedelics look and feel quite different. And so there's lots of really nice research now suggesting that psilocybin, for instance, is effective in the treatment of depression when accompanied by therapy. And that has a different mechanism of action and a different experience when you're going through it. And there are hypotheses about why it works. So, for instance, people have this very unusual experience that can be deeply introspective and meditative and beautiful. It may make you relinquish strongly held beliefs. So, for instance, a belief might be men shouldn't talk about their feelings, or a belief might be I'm the type of person who doesn't talk about their feelings. And that might loosen that belief and then supported by a therapist to then integrate that experience, whether it was beautiful or frightening or unusual, combined with what we think is probably opening a critical learning period, right? So you can be more like a child who learns quickly and changes quickly than like an adult, and we tend to get rigid and stuck. So those medications are equally promising, I think. The research is in a fairly early stage, but just that type of thing that you're talking about, that kind of the stuckness that happens to people when they are mentally unwell, it might be something that can loosen that up a little bit.
And I wonder if you could share, you use this I think the word's anecdote or way of explaining around this kind of snow on the kind of I wonder if you could share, because I've used this many times when I was talking to people about this since, and I really love it for anyone to kind of get this, to really help like labour that idea that it's kind of creating those new paths. And I'll just let you explain it.
So the idea that is a metaphor that I kind of developed. So one of the types of therapy I use is a therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is related to approaches like mindfulness. And fundamentally, mindfulness is sort of anything that isn't thinking, you know? So if you're doing something or paying attention to something, like a formal meditation practice, or like us talking, like this, you know, this, you could think of that as a type of kind of meditation. All of those approaches are, they tend to be much healthier than kind of thinking. And rumination, which is this very stuck kind of thinking that depressed people tend to do, is a big risk factor for depression and anxiety. And it's the way that people get to depression and anxiety often. They think too much. You know, there's a Western kind of conceit, I think, which is that thinking is good. You know, we work out problems, you know, we become engineers and scientists and you have to think. But actually, a lot of smart people especially think that they can think their way out of the problems, but actually what ends up happening is you get stuck in this kind of tumble dryer of rumination. And so the idea with mindfulness and acceptance and commitment therapy is to kind of step back from the thinking and to observe what's going on rather than be inside it, if that makes sense. And so I sometimes think that when people are very distressed, it's like you're in a blizzard, right? You can't see 2 feet in front of you. It's frightening, it's disorienting, and you don't know what to do. And the snow globe metaphor is that the blizzard's there, right? But you can imagine as if you're holding a snow globe and observing it happening rather than being inside it and stuck. And it's just, you're taking a different position where you're sort of observing what's going on with you rather than being stuck in the storm, if that kind of makes sense.
It's very hard to see. Like often when we're stuck in something difficult, it's hard to see a way out. It's kind of like I often say, like when you're in the depths or darkness of depression, it's kind of like you've dug this hole of like thinking, and like you're in this bad place. You've dug this hole really, really deep to the point where you look up and like you can only see a glint of blue sky, but you can't really see it. And like there's people outside living their life and walking around. There's happiness and joy out there, but you can't even imagine that because you're so deep in this dark hole. Yeah. And like you need a way to kind of come up and be able, almost like to put a few boxes underneath you to get your head out.
Get your head above the clouds.
Above the clouds, above into the ground and see. And I say that's where the role of whether it's medication, whether it's therapy, whatever it might be, some of it is giving you that clarity, because it is very hard. I mean, I've said this before, I am one of those people with a very strong internal monologue, very critical monologue. And I think it is part of, you know, people who are, I guess, smart, whatever you want to call it. You're real thinkers. I wonder if it's partly why, you know, they talk about like philosophers and stuff like that. They say they end up really depressed because they think about things so much.
That's right.
It's part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's very difficult to separate sometimes having a mind that really thinks and like considers challenges in the world or thinks of things in certain ways from a mind that becomes quite heavily internally critical.
Yeah.
It's very hard to separate those things.
Yeah, that's great. So I often talk to patients about there's different types of thinking. There's there's like contemplation, which is like lightly holding a problem in your mind and toying with it in that kind of helpful way, thinking it through. There's mindfulness we've talked about, which is observing, experiencing, and that's really nourishing, that's really good. And then there's rumination, which is that stuck tumble dryer type of thinking. And then you can shift how you're thinking. So when you're going for a walk, people will often say, when I go for a walk, I don't ruminate, you know, because something different is happening. You're moving through space. Maybe you're in nature and your body is moving. So it feels very different. So I think it is important for people to recognize that's not the only type of thinking, and that you can do different things to have a different type of thinking. Talking to a person is another different type of thinking, because two minds together is not ruminating. It's a different type of thing. So I think that's super rich thing to bring out for people.
That's fundamentally why with men, we do want men to talk, because as soon as you kind of talk about something, you are with someone else, you're suddenly getting an external point of view that doesn't have the weight of heaviness of negativity that you have towards your own view, that goes, hang on, been a bit harsh on yourself there, or have you thought about this perspective? And I think that's why I remember, I often say that, tell the story. I remember, like, I've always been someone that carries, my friends always say I'm a coper. I'll deal with anything. I'm like, there's almost anything you throw at me, I'll get through it. But for many years, I'd always do that alone. I'd be quiet about it. And I remember at med school, I just go into this terrible place of darkness and difficulty, and eventually I was like, I just can't carry on like this. And I spoke to my mum, and I had this, first of all, huge outpouring of emotion, but also at least half of that pain disappeared instantly.
Yeah.
Because it just shared it, and all of a sudden she was like, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh. She's like, people feel like that sometimes. And you're like, it wasn't invalidating, it was a very much validating response, but you just felt that huge oomph off your shoulders. And I think that's, you know, ultimately, you know, with that, for example, my brother, that's the thing, you think, gosh, you know, if you could have just shared that, perhaps you'd have realized not just that your problems were solvable, but they were actually they didn't have to be as burdensome as you perhaps thought they were. You know, and I think that is such it's a big part of that, kind of why the anti-stigma is so important, isn't it?
It is. And there's so much in what you said there. One is that we get stuck in our heads, but we're deeply social apes, and any recovery is possible in the context of a nourishing relationship, whether that's with a therapist or a parent or a friend. And unburdening yourself and realizing that all that stuff going on in your head, sometimes it's the snow and the slow globe. So when you talk to your mum, it's like you're both looking at the snow globe and you're like, oh, it's actually just the snow globe.
Just a blizzard happening. Just a blizzard. It'll pass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just realizing this too shall pass is one of my favorite tattoos on my arm.
Yeah.
This too shall pass.
That's right.
It's one of the, if anyone can realize anything, it, you know, whatever it is, it'll go.
Yeah.
As bad as it can be.
That's right.
It'll go.
And perspective taking, right? You know, you said getting your head above the clouds. Mm. And, you know, I mean, mental health is really complex and I resist any attempt to simplify it. But one thing that is common through all mental disorders is they're all stuck loops. They're all vicious cycles. Mm. And if you can change any one of the little nodes in that kind of stuck loop, then you can change things. Mm. And sometimes perspective taking is the one thing.
You know? Sometimes a bit of perspective gives you clarity.
Yeah, just seeing it differently, yeah.
Well, we'll come to the end of part one on that note. Thank you so much for joining us, part one, everyone. We'll see you very soon in part two. Goodbye.
If you're looking for more mental fitness content, check out my book, The Mind Manual, Mental Fitness Tools for Everyone, and A Better Day and A Better Day Journal for Children. And if you have a man in your life, or indeed if you're a man listening to this, make sure you check out Mettl, the app, Mettle, mental fitness tools that are designed for men. Download now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.